Peter Wolf is my guest today on Fresh Air. In the liner notes for Wolf's new album, Peter Guralnick wrote, "This is real soul music, delivered neither as formal imitation nor as ironic commentary, but full of the emotion that invested the records and shows that served as Peter's inspiration and initiation." Wolf chose to record Fool's Parade in the old style, live in a small studio on vintage equipment, to capture an intimate feel like the soul records of the 1960s.
Well, for me, the way this record started, I had always grew up being first generation rock and roller, growing up with the impact of Elvis Presley and Little Richard and groups like the Orioles and the Ravens, having an older sister who was a dancer on the Alan Freed Big Beat Show. I got to go see a lot of the great early rock and roll pageantries. My dad was in light opera and vaudeville, so I got to catch a lot of the end of that great era. And I sort of synthesized a lot of that music. And as time moved on and as technology moved on, the ways of making records changed. And when I was, before starting this Fool's Parade project, I started finding myself going back to mainly a lot of the music from Memphis. And by that, the records from Sun, the Sam Phillips records, there were great recordings of Howlin' Wolf, the recordings of Little Junior Parker, Elvis Presley, and Johnny Cash, and also later Stax, the recordings of Otis Redding. And then Muscle Shoals was a great impact. And I was listening to a record by Arthur Alexander, and it just, the warmth of those recordings and the approach of those recordings. And basically, they were very intimate. They were good songs done in a small room, done in a very intimate atmosphere, using great old warm tube equipment that was the standard equipment of the time. Great players, and you got a certain feeling from that that I felt had been lost in many contemporary records. And so for myself, I really wanted to get back to that approach. And that's how I sort of proceeded as the blueprint for Fool's Parade.
So on the one hand, you have this sound that you're going after. And on the other hand, you have lyrics that seem to me to have an awful lot to do with taking stock of your life, looking back, in some cases regretting disappointments, in other cases moving on. One of the songs that I'm thinking of is Turnin' Pages, and I wanted to listen to just a little bit of it.
Gathering the songs for this record, I tried to choose and stay in a direction where there was a certain amount of intimacy that dealt with a lot of what was going on in my life. The trials and tribulations in a previous album, I had this song called Long Line, and the lyrics, if I can remember, were, "Here I am, baby, right back where I've been. I've been tossed around, kicked around on the outside looking in. Every mountain has its valley, every valley has its climb. I got these weary blues from trying, cause it's a long, long line." And what I meant was that there was a lineage as I, a young kid growing up in the Bronx, taking the subway down to Times Square Records and hearing young doo-wop groups, Dion and the Belmonts, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, the Schoolboys, great New York doo-wop groups, hearing these bands, and then going to art school, coming up to Boston to study painting, And hearing that Muddy Waters was in town, and I'm 17 years old, and I'm, you know, helping Muddy Waters carry his equipment, his amplifiers, and end up becoming sort of his unofficial valet while he was in the New England area. And then putting together a band eventually, much later on when I was about 18, 19, and ending up playing with people like Muddy Waters and Helen Wolf and John Lee Hooker, Mose Allison. And so there was this long line, this lineage that these artists, these great artists like Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, they received when they grew up in Mississippi, and they brought it with them up north. Then they went across to England and inspired people like the Rolling Stones and many different bands. The Beatles were inspired, and then came back here and inspired people like myself. And I think that's what I know Peter as a writer, Peter Gerlnick, who you mentioned earlier, has devoted most of his life to, is capturing that tradition.
I'm talking today with singer Peter Wolf. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Wolf. His new album is Fool's Parade. You know, you referred to yourself as a first-generation rock and roller, and I'm thinking about the fact that rock and roll is really conceived as music for youth. And now you have people in your generation in their 50s still making rock and roll. And I was really struck by a remark of yours in Billboard magazine in 1996, where you said, there's a part of rock and roll that's pure adolescence, but it's not only that. I've gotten rid of that albatross. I don't feel like I'm a gerbil in a cage anymore. And you're known as a very wild performer. And I'm wondering if you aren't in some way saying through your songs and to me right now that you're trying to grow up.
Well, I think I was always trying to grow up. I think we're all trying to learn. And as a musician and as an artist, we're all trying to have growth. I just think one grows up, certain things become important. And when I was going to high school, I went to the High School of Music and Art in Manhattan, which was on 135th Street. And it was right about 10 blocks away from the Apollo Theater. So I would go, before going home to the Bronx, taking the subway back to the Bronx, I would stop off at the Apollo every Wednesday. And I did that for about 4 years. And I got to see an amateur show, an entire review, and then the entire, what they called Showtime, Star Time. And I got to see people like, you know, Dinah Washington and all the great Stax reviews and Jimmy Weatherspoon and Jackie Wilson and Billy Stewart and some of America's greatest, or the world's greatest poets and entertainers, and all the great comedians, Pigmeat Martin and Moms Mabley and Young Flip Wilson. And the presentation and the origins of soul music at that time had this great impact on me, because there was a tremendous treatment of the stage. The stage was considered a very religious, sacred place, and there was a communion between the performer and the audience, and it was the performer's obligation to stir up, almost like a gospel preacher, his audience, which was his congregation. And there was this communion between the audience, and when Jackie Wilson would get down on his knees and start singing some love song, the women went crazy. Or if James Brown hit the stage and said, you know, we're going to let the good times roll, we're going to shake it up, or Ray Charles, there was this energy and this magnificent passion that happened that once, as a young kid, it affected me. To this day, I think about some of those moments, and they're so profound to me.
You know, I'm really struck listening to you talk about these people who are important to you, and it is a parade of incredible names, not only as influences, but also people who are a part of your life. And when you read your biography, if you forget for a moment the part about having an IQ of 70, it sounds like Forrest Gump to me. I mean, you have encountered all of these incredible people, and this cast of characters includes Norman Rockwell and Bob Dylan and David Lynch and John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters and Van Morrison and, of course, Jay Giles and Faye Dunaway. And I wonder if it's as amazing to you as it is to someone like me, imagining what it must have been like to have, I mean, Norman Rockwell?
Well, yeah, that was a funny story. When I was very young, when I was about 2 and a half, I feverishly started drawing, and I became an impassioned drawer. And matter of fact, we lived in this tenement building. My apartment was very much like the Honeymooners' apartment with Jackie Gleason. My parents slept in a convertible couch. My sister and I shared a bedroom. It was crammed with junk and furniture. My mother collected antiques, and we had two cats, a dog, parakeet, and we're in this hovel, this small little apartment. And my dad was out of work a lot because it was hard getting jobs. My mom was a left-wing activist, and she had a hard time getting work in the 50s. And we grew up, and at one point my dad, as Tanglewood started, we went up to, my dad found some work up there as Bernstein was working up there. And we took a drive to Sturbridge. And
what kind of work did he do?
He sang. He was a vaudevillian. He sang. He did light opera. When he left home when he was 14 to join the Schubert Theater, he was with the Schuberts when they had their own trains. And he was the chorus boy, they called it at that time, in performances and productions like The Student Prince and Merry Widow.
So you go up there to Tanglewood, which is in the town of Stockbridge, which is known not only for Tanglewood, but also as the home of a very famous American painter.
Right, and it was Stockbridge, right? And my dad, we're driving into some small little town, and it was outside of Lenox, I remember, and he parks the car and said he had to do some shopping, but he wanted to take me up to someone to visit. And we went up stairs, these steps, and there was this gentleman who knocked on the door, and he had this art studio. And my father said, my son loves to draw and paint, and would you mind, I have some errands to do, would you mind if he sat here and watched you work? And the gentleman said, no, it'd be fine, what's your name? I said, Peter. He said, well, I have a son named Peter, just your age too, and he loves to draw and paint, and blah, blah, blah. And he gave me a sheet of paper, and he was painting away, and this happened quite a few times. My dad would drop me off, and I would stay in this man's studio and talk to him and ask him certain things, and it turned out to be Norman Rockwell. And I was 4 or 5, I had no idea who he was, just that he was a very sweet man, and really took an interest in, he was very engaging. So I have my dad to thank for that.
And then you went on to study painting in Boston.
I studied painting. I went to the High School of Music and Art, which was a very tough academic school. It was there was three or four what they called specialized high schools in New York in the public systems. One was the Bronx High School of Science, Stuyvesant, which was another science school, and High School of Music and Art. And that's when I first ran into some of that called these cool cats who going down the village, and we were all like, 14, 15, and they were going to see these different jazz and bebop players, and that's when I kind of first caught up with, there was Charlie Mingus and Thelonious Monk would play at the 5 Spot, and they would switch off different weeks, and I got to see them, and they sort of kind of blew my mind. And it was at this point, about 14 and a half, 15, I moved out of my house in the Bronx, and I and two friends took over one of their father's studios in Manhattan, and that's I lived there and finished up high school.
You finish high school, you go to Boston to the Boston Museum.
After I didn't actually finish high school. I never graduated. I failed gym a couple of times, and I thought maybe going to summer school for gym just. and a couple of things didn't kind of seem in my cue card, so I ended up doing what a lot of ladies and gents of my age did, which was sort of hitchhike around America to seek and find adventure and sanctuary throughout. There would always seem to be this great romantic sense that there was some wonderment out there in the hinterlands, and I ended up going out towards the Midwest. Friends of mine were in Chicago and Wisconsin. There was these great folk societies, and people like Ray Glover and Dylan and the Greenbrier Boys, and the University of Wisconsin was a foundation for a lot of great folk music, and I stayed out there for a while. And then I ended up at the University of Chicago as an art student, but I never, people thought I was enrolled in the school. I was just using their art classes. I never really was a student, and I was sleeping in the dorms.
So you posed as a student so you could use the facilities.
Right.
Yeah.
And I did that in many places. The great place was in Brandeis. I showed up so frequently that they ended up giving me the keys and made me the monitor of the art building.
This is very much like Forrest Gump. Peter Wolf's new album is Fool's Parade. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dean Olscher, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dean Olscher. We're talking today with singer and songwriter Peter Wolf, who, after 17 years with the Jay Giles Band, started a solo career in the mid-1980s. His new CD is called Fool's Parade. It's the culmination of a most interesting life. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, he was in the middle of a music and art scene that included Van Morrison, David Lynch, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, no relation, and Faye Dunaway, to whom he was married for several years. It was a very busy life.
I think what has a great play in here is I am inflicted with this disease called insomnia. And so that is what sort of has, I think, played a great part in my adventures or nocturnal ramblings or my wanderlust. And, you know, there's something really wonderful that happens at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, between those hours and dawn, that for me is very special. I don't know. It's sort of like what people think goes on when there's a full moon. There's a sort of chemical change that happens to me, and I can listen to music better. I enjoy, you know, walking out better. Cigarettes seem to taste better.
When your name is Wolf, I guess it makes sense that a full moon.
There you go.
Yeah. When you were in Boston at that time, you were living with David Lynch, the filmmaker. He was your roommate. This was
long before
he went on to make Blue Velvet, and he kicked you out, right?
Well, we had a problem with it was a very small apartment. We were living on a bunk bed. I didn't have any money. I was always kind of late with the rent, which drove David crazy. And he and I we were a complete antithesis as far as music taste and painting. I mean, he was into high, you know, abstract expressionism. And I was very sort of engulfed with the school of the German expressionists, and I was studying Beckmann and Kirchner and George Grosz, who are some of my favorite artists still are. And we would have these passionate arguments and about these theories. And then when music had to play, he loved a lot of the more kind of contemporary sort of standard stuff that was happening at the time, and I was putting on these, you know, crazy things, you know, Thelonious Monk and Blind Reverend Gary Davis. And we had this one, he just thought I was a little bit too crazy because, you know, he'd be trying to get to sleep at about 1 o'clock and I was just revving up. And I think we were just so confined in the small little, it was just this one little tiny room, sort of like a little prison cell. That one day he said, "Man, you're just too crazy, you know, and you owe me all this money. You know, I think it'd be best if you move out." And I was sort of heartbroken, and I didn't know where to stay, and I was searching around for a place to stay. And many, 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 many years later, David had gone on, and he was making movies and doing, building up quite a reputation for himself, and I was doing a video for the song called Come As You Are, and it was done on the set of Universal, and it was a video that was based on a previous choreographed, I think Berkeley did it, and it was where the main character in this scene just starts jumping through this entire little small town, and he's continually jumping, and it required many, many, many hours of just jumping, which is very hard to do, and I didn't realize it until we started shooting this thing. And the director of photography was Fred Elms, I believe his name was, who shot all the Race Ahead for David and Blue Velvet. And he's mentioned he was going to have dinner with David, and I hadn't seen David in, you know, a couple of decades. So I wrote him a little note, and I got him this book that I thought he might like, City of Nets by Otto Frederick, which was a great book about the decline of the Hollywood movie system. And David wrote back this little note saying, "Hey, great to hear from you. You know, congratulations on everything, blah, blah, blah. P.S., by the way, you still owe me $38 for rent."
That's got to be a little bit of a jolt to hear from the maker of Eraserhead that you're too crazy. You know what I mean?
Well, I kind of took it as a compliment.
Now, when you were in Boston then, in those days, you became a radio DJ.
Yes, I became the Wolf of Goof of Mama Tufa, the all-night radio show. Welcome to Little Ladies and the Night Kid from Alabama. All the ships at sea, doing a tune and getting right through. If it's got to come out, give us a call. Don't you still want to have some fun until the midnight sun. This is Wolf of Goof of Mama Tufa, and I would, you know, play things like, you know, Van Morrison and Muddy Waters and Bob Dylan and Hank Williams and Jackie Wilson and Screamin' Jay Hawkins and Thelonious Monk and Velvet Underground. It was just, you know, it was a ball.
Back in the days when radio was not run by consultants and focus groups.
Exactly. The DJs were the program director. I was actually the program director and the music director, because how that station came about was a funny story, because the fellow that put it together was living on the floor of my apartment. It's a kind of long episodic story, but he asked me to be, he asked me if I want to do a show, and so I did that, and I did it for a year or two, and at that point, the Jay Giles Band was just starting up, and then eventually it just became difficult to kind of keep two things going as the Giles Band started to travel. But I loved it because, you know, I took phone calls, and it was a real link with that strange nocturnal world. And when musicians would come into town, you know, I think back at the people I interviewed, and I want to take a sort of gun to my head, and when I think I didn't let the tape roll, because I had interviewed Van Morrison and Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, Carla Thomas, Howlin' Wolf, Mose Allison, Freddie Hubbard, Led Zeppelin in their first, when they first came in, Ronnie Wood and Rod Stewart and Jeff Beck, and I just, you know, can't think of all the people that came through there. And, you know, they just drop by the station, and we just talk and play records and, you know, ask them to pick records, and Bobby Blue Bland, and it just, it was pretty amazing.
And you did this all in this persona that you had.
Well, I did it as the Wolf of Goof of Mama Tufa, because I guess I always considered myself a painter. So as I started getting into music, there was this other personality that came out. And then as I got into radio, I also based it on many of the great disc jockeys that I grew up with in New York. And that's another thing that gets lost a lot as people write about the history of rock and roll. The incredible importance of radio. And by that I mean these great artists that were DJs. The DJs were supreme. They were these incredible characters, these incredible personalities. They were so seductive, and they captivated you day, hour after hour. And they had impeccable tastes, and they played great music, and they all had these great gimmicks and characters. I remember growing up, we had this big, huge radio, because this is before transistors, and I'd listen to Alan Freed during the early evening, and then I would listen to Jocko's Rocket Ship Machine. And it was Jocko Henderson, and it was Oop-Bop. Badoo, how do you do? Time right now is 11:15, and you're listening to Jocko and his Rocket Machine. Zap-bop-a-day, zo-bo-ba-doo. And he'd go on like that and throughout the night and rhyme and, you know, play great music. And, you know, we're blasting off 10, 9, 8, 7. This is going to send you up to heaven. Here they are, the Cadillacs with Speedo. And after him was the Magnificent Montague. And he had songs for lovers. And he would, this was about midnight, and my sister, of course, was, Peter, turn that radio down. And I had the radio under the covers, and he'd go, ladies, if your man is giving you the blues, I want you to put that radio right down where you know where, and let the Magnificent satisfy you. And then after he went off the air, I would turn the dial, and Symphony Sid would be live from Birdland, and he'd be playing, you know, this incredible, you know, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers and, you know, Horace Silver and Bobby Timmons. And, you know, I was just, you know, soaking up all this great music, and he would interview all these different people, and it'd be live from Birdland, and Pee Wee Marquette, who was the young announcer, you know, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Birdland right now, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, jazz capital of the world. And these great disc jockeys and supplied this incredible amount of knowledge and inspired, you know, thousands and thousands of young kids. And, you know, we would go off the next day and keep lists and go off and run to record stores. And I think that's what Peter was talking about in the liner notes, is that we were very passionate And I guess some of us still are. We just, you know, I consider myself a fan. I go see a lot of new bands all the time, and, you know, I really respect those who have that sort of link in, you know, new bands that seem to be carried on, and to me it's very promising. Though I think the state of radio is a disastrous state. It's the radio I'm talking about doesn't really exist anymore.
My guest is singer-songwriter Peter Wolf. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Peter Wolf about his career in music and in radio. In the 1970s, he was a late-night DJ on WBCN in Boston. So you come up at this very special time where you're on the radio. You're not only a fan, but you get to do this thing on the radio where you are making available to listeners this incredible variety of music that you're interested in. And you do it in a persona that is not your own. And I wonder, though, if that's something that you carry on as a songwriter. And I'm thinking in particular of a song like Ride Lonesome Ride Hard. In fact, let's just listen to a little bit of this song.
I used to treat the world like it was made for me. I took the love I found like it was all for free. I'm here to tell you there's a price to pay on that lost highway.
When you write something like this, are you thinking as a character, a narrator, say, in a story, or are we hearing you speak in your own voice?
Well, Ride Lonesome, Ride Hard was a it was a title I had with me for a while, and there was this sort of road. It just represented some sort of wandering and some sort of, you know, when you're working as a musician on the road, there's this kind of, you get into this activity that's unlike anything else, because you're traveling from one city to another, and you move in at night, and you go from sound check to performance to hotel to, and with the Jay Giles Band, we were together for 17 and a half years with the same personnel. And we traveled endlessly. We, you know, went from, you know, doing little stops down south and playing, you know, Fayetteville, North Carolina, and Greensboro the next night. And, you know, we, not realizing it, but after year after year after year after year, we were just sort of emulating a lot of the great artists that came before us unconsciously, just by the act of surviving. And Ride Lonesome really wasn't a character. It is me, because... you know, it's sort of this, the things that you have to leave behind as when you're out on the road. This could be you and me crying on the avenue with nothing but our loneliness and crimes that we cannot confess, and you got to ride lonesome, ride hard, because at the end of the day, in those wee hours, not to sound corny, but, you know, you're there, you know, me, myself, and I, and that's kind of what that song is about. It's, there's a certain bravado, I think, that you might be talking about as a performer, as, you know, with the Giles Band that, you know, I took on, and it was a certain kind of thing that I tried to emulate from many of the great soul and R&B shows. Things like in a Giles song, Must Have Got Lost, where, you know, repeated the beauty, let down your long hair, this wolf a goof, mama too, tell you love comes once, when it comes, you gotta grab it fast, no telling how long the love you grab is gonna last, and then, you know, introducing a song came out of the whole tradition that I learned at the Apollo.
You spent 17 years with the Jay Giles Band, And you've said openly that you were thrown out in 1983. Creative differences is a euphemism that comes up a lot in these kinds of situations, and it came up here with you. And I wonder what happened.
Well, it was creative differences. It really wasn't about money or this. And I think when we made a record that finally got into, you know, sort of the top of the charts, shall we say, that's when all these sort of difficulties really started emerging.
You used the phrase once, group psychoses.
Yeah, the decision of how we should move forward, what should the next approach be, it got difficult, and it caused a sort of fratricide that started as a small thing and just started growing and became very cancerous and ended up where, you know, the majority of the band thought it'd be best maybe they go their way, and I would, you know, sort of do best to go my way. I remember, not to do any disservice to the Giles band, but I remember at one point going to the movie Spinal Tap, and I'm sitting in the theater, and you know, everybody's laughing. And I'm sort of in back of the theater, you know, totally sullen because, you know, this wasn't a joke. This was a documentary.
Ouch.
You know? it wasn't about Stonehenges and small Stonehenges, and it wasn't that trivial, but many of the passions and the dramas that happen in a band were captured so brilliantly by Rob Reiner. And they became very paralytic, and it was... For me, it's unfortunate because no one really wins. Because a great band, they come along so rarely, and I really think the Giles band was a great band. We were like the Brooklyn Bums, you know, the Brooklyn Dodgers. You know, we were like this bar band. We came out, you know, we fought against all odds. You know, our musicianship. We had this great passion, and I think what audiences responded to was that. You know, they could tell we were giving every ounce of credibility we could muster up. And if we were exhausted, I'm very proud to say in 17 and a half years, there might be only one show that I felt we didn't give our entire all. And, you know, we just would build up our audiences and just year after year after year after year, we just pounded away. And I'm proud of that. I look back at it and I think of it with a great fondness. And this also... it's a bittersweet kind of thing. It was a part of my life for an awful long time.
Peter Wolf, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Singer and songwriter Peter Wolf, this is Room Full of Angels from his new album.
to fade.
This is Fresh Air.